The blast sent chunks of his charred skull through the massive windows, which exploded instantly from the overpressure, propelling thousands of shards of glass onto the beautiful beach below. Tedesco's body was cut completely in half by the blast, and the parts of Admiral Pilsner that extended above his massive wooden desk simply ceased to exist. Rhys set down the cell phone on the late Mike Tedesco's dining room table and looked at Tedesco's widow, who sat just feet away gently rocking their newborn infant. Janet Tedesco quickly went back to stroking her baby's head, but she thought she detected a hint of sadness in the big man's eyes. When she looked back up, he was gone. Chapter 54, San Diego, California. Leonard Howard had been somewhat of a failure in the civilian practice of law. He did well academically in law school, but was unprepared for the chaotic workload of a civil litigator. He also found that despite his dreams to the contrary, he was abysmal in the courtroom. Whenever the partners would send him in to cover a routine motion hearing, he would panic. His confidence would shatter, his mouth would go powder dry, and his voice would crack. He was quickly let go from the firm and found himself adrift. There was only one place where a lazy lawyer who was scared of the courtroom could thrive: government service. A law school friend told him about the Navy JAG program, and he was immediately sold. The uniform brought him instant pride and prestige, and the complicated bureaucracy of the military gave him an environment in which to excel. He particularly loved signing his emails "Judge," an unauthorized way to psychologically elevate himself through the electronic communications medium. More than two decades into his uniformed service, Howard had risen to the rank of captain and was the Judge Advocate General of the Naval Special Warfare Command. When his friends and neighbors in the San Diego suburb of Eastlake mistakenly referred to him as a SEAL because of his work on the staff of a SEAL flag officer, Howard never corrected them. Admiral Pilsner treated him like a trusted ally, and together they wielded the full power and influence of the U.S. Navy against anyone who stood in their way. It was very much us versus them. Pilsner's political connections had made him a likely candidate to run the Pentagon, and Howard would rise alongside him as his most trusted confidant. Captain Howard had an appointment that morning and would be arriving to work at WARCOM later than usual. Most men his age were long past the stage of needing braces on their teeth, but Howard's teeth had been in such horrible shape from a lifetime of neglect that his wife had finally convinced him to do something about it. She secretly hoped it would help his chronic halitosis as well as his appearance. The Navy denied his application to have braces put on, citing the purely cosmetic reason of his request. Unfortunately for him, the same bureaucracy in which he prospered could also be an insurmountable hurdle to climb. He shelled out the money to pay for the braces himself and had a regular visit with his civilian orthodontist out in the suburbs. He turned off his cell phone during the office visit per the sign on the door, powering it back up as he walked outside to what they now called a sports activity vehicle. His Navy-issued BlackBerry came alive with every conceivable alert when he turned it on, and it reconnected to the network. Voicemails, text messages, and emails had all come through while his device had been turned off. He scanned the emails first and stopped in his tracks as he opened the most recent message. "Explosion at WARCOM, two dead, evacuate immediately." He checked the voicemail from his deputy, a wave of nausea coming over him, when he heard the news that Admiral Pilsner had been killed by an explosion in his office, likely a terrorist attack. He immediately hit his local news app to see if there was more updated information available. Heart pounding, blinking to clear his vision, Howard tried to fight back what felt like an anxiety attack as he read the headline in shock: "Local moderate Islamic leader decapitated in brutal hate crime." Instantly clicking on the link, he read, "San Diego Imam Hamadi Ismail Massoud was murdered late last night in an apparent hate crime. His decapitated head was found this morning by neighbors impaled on the spike of a wrought iron gate to the mosque where he lived and served as the director of Islamic services for the Islamic Center for Peace and Prosperity of Southern California. Without hesitation, he dialed his wife's mobile number. "Amy, listen to me. Don't talk. Go get the kids out of school right now and take them to the airport. I'll meet you there." "No, I don't have time to explain, and yes, it has to do with what you're seeing on the news. Gerald is dead. We have to go now. I'll meet you at the ticket counter. Throw some warm weather clothes in a bag and go." Leonard Howard climbed into his BMW X3 and sped out of the parking lot towards San Diego International Airport. Chapter 55. Alpine, California. By the time the news of the explosion broke, Reese was on the road to the town of Alpine in the mountains northeast of San Diego. 40 minutes later, he was winding his way up the dirt road toward the canyon, a private, 1,000-yard rifle range owned by his friend, Clint Harris. Harris had hoped to turn the site, built on an old runway high in the hills, into a full training complex for military and law enforcement use. Unfortunately, he'd been sued by environmental groups and tied up in litigation ever since. He could still use the range for private guests. He just couldn't run it as a business until the lawsuits were settled. Harris was a smart and successful businessman and was no joke with a rifle. He had spent time behind the scope in Southeast Asia, and even at 68 years of age, he could still match and often surpass the skills of Reese's top snipers. He loved having Reese and his operators up to the range to train so he could test himself against the best. Harris was also an off-the-grid kind of guy and had no great love for the federal government. When Reese had approached him with this ask, he agreed without hesitation. Even though Harris didn't have a family, he risked imprisonment and financial ruin if he were ever discovered to have aided Reese's escape. Reese knew the combinations to both gates en route to the compound and steered directly toward the open roll-up garage door where Harris stored and maintained the vehicles used on the training site. Harris backed a Polaris Ranger utility vehicle up to the tailgate of Reese's cruiser and was busy transferring gear, including a parting gift from Marco, from the cruiser to the Ranger, before Reese could get the vehicle into park. Marco had his driver deliver a backpack filled with $100,000 in multiple denominations of U.S. currency soon after their Mexico excursion, so that Reese would not be able to refuse it. Inside was a handwritten note reading, "Just in case you need traveling money, my friend. Keep the change. Marco." Reese jumped out alongside Harris and helped him continue loading the heavy Pelican weapons cases and bags into the bed of the Ranger. "Can't thank you enough for this, Clint. I mean it."
"You do it for me, Reese. That's all that matters. Now say goodbye to your girlfriend here. I promise it'll be a quick death."
Reese patted his beloved Land Cruiser to say goodbye after many years of faithful service. He knew that it would be gone by sunrise the next morning, probably at the bottom of the nearby Loveland Reservoir. Harris pulled the chains to lower the garage door, and they both climbed into the Ranger. The noise of the Polaris's engine made it too loud to talk as they drove the short distance out to the range. There wasn't much to say anyway. Harris stopped at the north corner of the long, flat range and pulled a Motorola radio from his belt.
"Tighter, this is the canyon. Do you read me?"
"I've got you, Canyon. I'm 5 minutes out," replied a female voice with a southern accent that was discernible even over the scratchy radio signal.
"Roger, we're ready for you here. You've got light winds from the west, less than 3 miles per hour. Range is clear."
"Roger, Canyon. See you in 5.
"There she is."
Harris pointed to a speck on the horizon directly to the north. As the speck grew closer, Reese could hear the humming sound of a turboprop. The aircraft flew directly over their position before making a sweeping turn that put it in line with the opposite end of the old 1,000-yard runway. With the gears folded down and locked, and with the flaps at full extension, the pilot put the Pilatus PC-12NG down just ahead of the impact berm, taking advantage of every foot of available runway. The sleek, single-engine aircraft was painted silver and looked very much like a bird of prey. The plane's deceleration was rapid, and within 700 yards of the landing spot, the plane was taxiing at normal speed. The pilot passed the men in the Polaris and turned the plane 180 degrees, pointing the nose back in the direction it had come from. The plane came to a stop and the engine's RPMs decreased audibly as it went into ground idle, the engine continuing to run with the props feathered so as not to create any thrust. A few seconds later, the engine shut off and the prop began to slow. Almost immediately, the cabin door on the left side of the aircraft folded downward and all 5 feet 5 inches of Liz Riley stood in the cabin door. She was wearing aviator sunglasses and her hair was pulled back into a ponytail, covered by a crimson University of Alabama ball cap. She looked like she'd walked out of a CrossFit class instead of the cockpit of an aircraft, wearing a gray tank top and tight black nylon yoga pants. Her shoulders and arms were muscular without being masculine, courtesy of the gym addiction born during the rehab from her wartime injuries. Her right shoulder and part of her right arm were highlighted in a mural of intricate tattoos. She hopped swiftly down the steps of the Pilatus and embraced Reese in a bear hug.
"I'm so sorry about everything, Reese. I really am."
Reese returned the hug firmly, Liz being the closest thing to a sister he'd ever had.
"Your turn to save my ass, Liz."
"Gladly. Let's get your gear loaded and get you out of here."
Liz grabbed one of the kit bags and ran up the steps into the aircraft's cabin. She set the bag down and stood in the door.
"Y'all hand that stuff up to me. I need to get the balance right."
The men began offloading the Ranger's utility bed onto the deck of the aircraft, while Riley placed the various bags and cases in spots of her choosing. She wasn't the kind of girl whom you offered to help with the bags. She stood at the front of the cabin, pointing at the various items of kit as she made calculations in her head.
"Okay, boys, we're loaded. Get in, Reese."
Reese embraced Harris in a half-handshake, half-hug.
"See you when you get back," Harris said.
Reese nodded with a look that was unmistakable in its meaning.
"I'm not coming back."
Then he climbed the steps into the cabin. Liz pointed at his seat in the cockpit and he pulled the stairway door up, securing it. She climbed nimbly into the left seat, put on her headset, and talked herself through a rapid pre-flight checklist. Satisfied, she started the engine and ran the throttle up to full power, watching the tachometer rise. With the engine screaming, she released the wheel brakes and applied pitch to the spinning propeller blades. The aircraft surged forward, pushing Reese back into his seat as it accelerated down the dirt strip. 700 yards from their starting point, Liz pulled back on the yoke and the nose pointed rapidly skyward. The Pilatus cleared the impact berm by a healthy margin and gained altitude as the landing gear retracted into the fuselage. Liz turned the aircraft east and spoke for the first time since she'd assumed the controls.
"So, where to, Reese?"
Chapter 56. Capstone Capital Corporate Offices, Los Angeles, California. Horn had his assistant arrange the video conference in the same frosted glass room at Capstone where he'd hosted J.D. Hartley. This time, it was Secretary Hartley calling, and it would take all of his negotiating skills to talk her down. He had to keep this deal on the rails, or everything would be lost. The large LCD screen went from solid blue to an image of the secretary's conference room at the Pentagon. One of Hartley's aides confirmed that the video was live and then exited the camera's view, presumably to summon the secretary herself. Lorraine Hartley, without professional makeup and lighting, was not a pretty sight, and the video image did not help bolster her appearance. She looked exhausted and stressed. Clearly, she was not happy with the way things had spun out of control.
"Horn, I cannot believe that I let you and J.D. talk me into this thing. Pilsner is dead, Steve. Blown out of his office window like confetti, and one of my best fundraisers is dead with him."
"Madam Secretary, I am deeply saddened by the loss of the Admiral and Mike. Both were great men."
"Oh, save me the condolence act, Horn. They were hardly great men. All I care about is this thing staying under the radar. And with the bodies piling up, that is not what is happening."
"Madam Secretary, I understand why you're upset. I really do. These are setbacks to be sure, but let's be honest. Those men had served their purpose on this project. We now have less equity to share, and better yet, a platform to catapult you into the White House. This is your moment, Madam Secretary."
"What are you talking about?" How is this mess going to do anything other than land me in prison?
No one is going to prison, Lorraine. This is exactly the kind of issue that you need to establish yourself as a strong leader. Don't let that lame duck president be the face of this thing. Call a primetime press conference and tell the public about James Reese, the terrorist. He'll have every Hicktown cop in the country chasing him, and we know he won't let them take him alive. You'll look like you're already in the Oval Office, and you can use it to pass that domestic surveillance bill that you've been trying so desperately to get through Congress. The public will be scared shitless, and you'll be their savior.
You make a good point, Steve. We could really capitalize on this. But how do we know Reese isn't coming after us?
I have an asset that I've been holding in reserve, Lorraine, who can lead him right to his own demise. Get your best military or law enforcement units to hunt him down and tighten the noose, and my guys can finish the job. We give credit to whoever you want to owe you one, and we move forward with the next round of trials. This thing is going to work, Lorraine. You're going to be president, and we're going to make billions. With a B.
I'm giving you one last shot on this, Horn. This had better work, or I'll make sure you never see another dollar out of this agency's budget.
It will work, Lorraine. Trust me. Chapter 57. Riley had flown VFR out of North Las Vegas Airport, where she had returned in order to file a flight plan back to her home field in Texas. So long as she obeyed the visual flight rules, no one would question where she flew or, more important, where she'd landed. Once they were back on the ground in Nevada, Reese stayed in the cockpit wearing a hat and sunglasses while Riley filed her flight plan and supervised the refueling of the aircraft. Liz got permission from the North Vegas tower to take off, and they began the long trek to East Texas. Reese trusted Liz Riley in a way he trusted few, if any, other people in his life. He hadn't told the whole story from start to finish to anyone, and doing so took up most of the nearly four-hour flight. He started at the beginning, during the peculiar pre-mission planning before the ambush, all the way through the tragic events that followed. He told her about the tumors, the unauthorized clinical trial, and the involvement of the Hartleys. He told her how he'd created the list and had been working his way down it as efficiently as possible. The truth was, Reese wasn't a cold-blooded killer, and he needed Riley's moral compass to lean on. He wanted to ensure that he was doing the right thing, the thing that would make his men and his family proud. Liz was a good listener, never interrupting, letting Reese's discourse serve as his confessional. It was not lost on Reese or on Liz that he was transforming into an insurgent, his methods of killing blending his skills as an operator with the lessons he had learned over his years in special operations, studying terrorists, guerrillas, subversives, and assassins. If he had spent time thinking about it, he would have realized that his physical transformation matched the psychological one taking place within. He had raided the armory of his enemy and adopted clothes to blend into the populace, his long hair and beard making him look more like a logger from Oregon than a military man. Reese had always taken a hard line against prisoner abuse, regardless of what atrocity that prisoner had just committed. Even in the hardcore world of the SEAL teams, they were called anything but prisoners, detainees being the more polite term, though Reese always thought that sounded more like what cops did at traffic stops than what happened in war. As soon as they were flex-tied, their safety became the responsibility of the troop. Reese had no tolerance for any violence against the enemy once they were cuffed and under his control. It was one of the things that differentiated the United States from the enemy. Now, Reese had violated that most basic tenet of warfare, executing a man on his knees in Mexico. He had desecrated the body of the dead imam and left his head impaled on a spike in front of the mosque, forced another conspirator to wear a suicide vest onto a military installation to assassinate a high-ranking officer, murdered a federal agent while he slept, put a long-range projectile through the brain of an accountant, and tortured an attorney before intentionally overdosing him on narcotics. All that was prologue. He was not yet finished merging his highly honed abilities as a warfighter with the guerrilla tactics used against larger, more conventional militaries by terrorists the world over. His skills were the perfect fusion of elite special operator and cunning insurgent.
Reese, you are the strongest man that I've ever met, and I grew up around enough real men to know the difference. You've done it right, your entire career, your entire life, and you don't deserve any of this. Lord knows that Lauren and sweet Lucy didn't deserve it. Most would have cracked under that pressure and crawled into a hole. I hope you don't regret anything that you've done to avenge your family and your men, because as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing that you could do to these monsters that would be over the top. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about your risking your life to save